Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name's James Henderson. I'm head of the gas programme at OIES, and this podcast is on a gas topic, which we're recording on the 8th of May. I'm here today with my colleague, Vitaly Yermakov, who's actually sitting in Moscow as we speak. And we're going to be talking about his latest report called Catch 22 for Russian Gas, Plenty of Capacity Amid Disappearing Market. And you'll have gathered from that the topic here is clearly going to be Russian gas production. And we'll get on to a little bit about Russian exports as well. So Vitaly, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, James. Good to be here.
Okay, well, look, your report looked at 2022 and then the outlook for 2023. So why don't we start with a little bit of history? Tell me about what happened to Russian gas production in 2022 and what the main causes were.
The main message is in 2022, Russia saw the largest year-on-year drop in its gas output since 1990. Well, in fact, since wherever. And even more so for Gazprom. And that brings point number one, I think, in terms of major implications of what we have seen. Russian gas output declined, national output declined about 13%. It was reported at 673 BCM. That was very significant decline year on year. But for Gazprom, the drop was much larger. Gazprom's output declined 20% year on year. And basically, this tells the story of disproportionate effects of the shrinkage of demand. Because Russia's gas production is essentially demand driven. And the main driver in 2022 was the disappearing European gas market for Gazprom. That was the major driver for this declining output pattern.
Okay, so let's dig into that a little bit. So before I get onto Gazprom, let's start with the kind of the other, if you like, non-Gazprom producers. What happened to their production then?
Yeah, and as I already said, basically the numbers suggest that while Gazprom was going down, somebody else was going up, and Russian independents indeed managed to increase their output year on year. And we are talking here about Russia's largest gas independent, Novatek. But in fact, the growth story was not Novatek, but Russian oil companies that have significant gas projects, both associated gas and free gas. And these projects went ahead in 2022. To be sure, many of those were designed to be launched a few years back, but got delayed. And only in 2022, they finally went ahead. But why Gazprom really had to give way to those projects? I think that's a key question here. And there are several explanations to that. One of the most important ones is that several years ago, when Russia was very concerned about high volumes of gas flaring in the country, a set of rules was introduced that allowed associated gas to become first in line in terms of the merit order for access to the pipeline network. And in this sense, any associated gas, any processed dry gas derived from associated gas production would get first access to the pipeline network, and only then Gazprom would be able to deliver its own gas to the unified gas system. This created good incentives for the independents to reduce gas flaring and solved some of the problems a few years back, but also created some room for future growth for the independents' output. And they, in fact, signed a significant number of long-term contracts with end users in Russia, especially Rosneft. Rosneft secured about 80 BCM of gas supply to the final users via those long-term contracts with power utilities, with other major gas consumers. It didn't have enough its own gas production to cover all those contractual obligations. So for quite some time, Rosneft was buying gas from Gazprom just to meet the contractual terms. Now, especially in 2022, Rosneft managed to bring its own output up to significantly higher levels. This was primarily driven by two projects, Rospan. Production there started a few years ago, but we have seen a very significant ramp up in 2022. And then in 2022, another big project was launched, Kharampurskaya. This, in fact, was a joint venture between Rosneft and BP. BP exited the project, but Rosneft went ahead and started to ramp up production at Kharampurskaya very, very aggressively in 2022. Another important contributor to the growth for the independent gas was, in fact, a company related to Gazprom, Gazpromneft. It had a large Novoportovsk gas project. It recently completed the link between this field, which is on Yamal, quite far away from the gas network, from the unified gas system. But recently it completed the pipeline link to the main network, which allowed Gazpromneft to increase gas output at the field very significantly. This field produces oil, gas condensate, and gas production there basically was not very high, essentially due to infrastructural constraints. Once these were solved, the gas production went ahead.
Okay, so a good year for independent producers then, but as you say, Gazprom's taken a sort of disproportionate hit. That suggests that its fields are pretty flexible. I know your report goes into some kind of historical examples of how Gazprom manages flexibility in its fields. Could you just talk us through a little bit about how you think that flexibility was managed?
Well, another thing to mention, we don't have very good statistics on Russian gas production by individual fields anymore. Gazprom used to report the production data by fields, by major fields, for quite some time, but then it stopped doing so. And I guess, just like the truth is the first casualty of war, Russian gas statistics also became the casualty of war. We don't have the exact data for 2022, and we have to essentially rely on the previous years for when production data by fields was available. And basically, I think we can draw some useful analogies here. And for Gazprom, last year, I think they had this deja vu feeling that all over again, they are having this tremendous production surplus, production overhang, and they would need to think how to balance the performance of their fields, because their productive capacity was way, way higher than the overall demand for Gazprom gas. This same situation occurred just a few years ago in 2015 and in 2016. In fact, at that time, Gazprom's spare productive capacity was reported by company management at 150 BCM. In 2022, according to my estimates, it was about 117 BCM. Not a precise number, as I already said, that we don't have reported statistics, but merely an estimate. What allows Gazprom to accommodate those very wide swings in production is the nature of its asset base. Gazprom has several very large super giants in the Manian fields. This is basically not very low-laying gas, essentially very dry gas, very much like a network quality gas. It is suitable for doing these stop-and-go operations, basically stopping the field, stopping the wells, and then resuming production without damaging future productive capacity. And they had a very useful test run, or rather major rehearsal in 2015, 2016, when they managed to balance the output. And the evidence, historical evidence, suggests that at that time, they reduced output at their key fields. Then production at those main fields basically went all the way back, bounced back to the pre-crisis levels. And our expectation is that it just happened again this year. Gazprom managed to stop many wells during the summer. Then it resumed some production in the fall, but at low levels. And essentially, the expectation is that there was no much damage to the future productive capacity, and Gazprom will be able to resume production at much higher levels once demand returns. But that's, of course, as a key question. Will this demand for Russian gas return? Will demand for Gazprom gas return? And which markets will be available to Gazprom? Because Europe, of course, has pretty much disappeared as a major market for Russian gas in 2022.
So that's a good point, Vitaly. I mean, you bring that up. And in the paper, you mention that, you know, there is a question mark about the demand, future demand for Russian gas. But you sort of point out that the levels of flexibility in the big fields give Gazprom quite a lot of optionality going forward. There's always been a question mark about the, you know, the potential decline of some of the larger fields in Nadym-Pourtaz. And perhaps you could give us a little bit more insight into how you think Gazprom might kind of manage future supply and indeed investments, given the outlook for demand, certainly to Europe, is not as large as it has been in the past.
Well, first of all, having a huge amount of spare productive capacity, of course, represents a problem for Gazprom. This means that the investments that have been made now have become idle, and it's essentially lost money in terms of the opportunity cost. And hypothetically, and just to give you an example, about 100 BCM of spare productive capacity, if Gazprom were able to sell this gas to Europe, well, again, just a hypothetical example, at the price, say, $300 per 1,000 cubic meters, which is about 50% of the current level of prices in Europe, it would be able to receive $30 billion in terms of the sales revenue. So we are talking about huge amount of money. On the other hand, of course, there's always some silver lining. Having significant amount of spare productive capacity gives Gazprom a lot of flexibility in terms of meeting demand at home. And Russian gas demand pattern is very seasonal. There are significant spikes in winter gas consumption, essentially driven by the temperature, by extremely cold climate. During winter time, Gazprom not only has to push the fields to their maximum production levels, but also has to rely on withdrawals from storage. And in this sense, having a significant amount of spare productive capacity essentially removes any problems for Gazprom of dealing with the sudden spikes in gas consumption during winter time. Well, another point on the silver lining front would be the availability of a significant amount of gas for Russian domestic projects that would want to convert natural gas into some value-added product like nitrogenous fertilizer, because with fertilizers, it's essentially embedded gas in a different form. there are problems of marketing fertilizers as well, because you need to have sufficient amount of export infrastructure. All these additional supply, of course, cannot be accommodated by domestic demand. And so, again, the main market for higher nitrogenous fertilizers output would be, of course, exports. But it's just an example of how Gazprom could attempt to deal with all this extra gas it has. But overall, I think the only solution is to the real solution to the problem is to attempt to try to find alternative markets to Europe. Europe now is aiming at reducing the amount of imports of Russian gas to bare minimum, trying to get rid of Russian gas altogether in the future. Gazprom has been planning pivot east, signing several deals with China. And if things go according to plan, on the basis of the signed SPAs with China, Russia would be able to export to China about 48 BCM by 2025-26. But we are really talking about much, much higher volumes of stranded gas due to the lack of available export markets at the moment. So for Russia, it's very important to find some alternative routes. And the hope on Gazprom's side is to sign another giant sales contract with China for the so-called Power of Siberia 2 project, which is to build a pipeline that would connect the existing production on Yamal and in Nadimpurtas with China by pipeline that would run from Yamal, going through Nadimpurtas, and then via Mongolia to northern provinces of China, all the way to Beijing area. And given the fact that Russian contracts with China are oil indexed, at least for the moment, the Russian gas that arrives to China is priced very competitively in terms of sort of price differentials. It can very easily penetrate all the way to Shanghai, to the coastal areas, simply on the basis of price differentials and the transportation tariff that would need to be paid within China to transport this gas to additional areas. But for now, it's mostly being consumed in northeastern provinces of China.
So let's come back to the Asian pivot in a minute, if I may. Just before we go there, your paper talks a little bit about, you know, despite the fact the European market is disappearing, that actually there's quite a lot of revenues being generated still, and that, you know, you talk a little bit about the outlook for 23 and 24. Can you just talk us through a little bit about the numbers there, just briefly, before we go on to a bit more about Asia?
2022, of course, was a very special year. Just to remind you, for the first quarter of 2022, both production and exports of Russian gas to Europe were still following a very high trajectory, pretty much similar to 2021 when Russian gas exports hit one of the highest levels in recent history. And the major drop really started to happen from Q2. And then, of course, things started to accelerate. In this sense, Gazprom managed to get a lot of revenue early on in the year from exporting gas to Europe. And prices, of course, have never been as high as they were in 2022. Russia stopped reporting the data on state revenues from exports of pipeline gas, exports of LNG. Russia Customs stopped reporting this data. But looking at the statistics, at the available statistics from Europe, the reports, quarterly reports by the European Commission, they basically contain the following numbers. In Q1, Europe paid for Russian pipeline gas imports 27 billion euros. In Q2, it paid 20 billion euros. And in Q3, it paid only 9 billion euros. But overall, for the total, and at the moment we don't have the data for the full year for the fourth quarter and for the full year, but we are looking at approximately, given the cumulative exports for 2022 so far, the numbers close to maybe $70 billion. Just the numbers I mentioned before were in euros, and so when we convert that and add revenues from Q4, it will be a little bit shy of $70 billion on sales of Russian pipeline gas to Europe only. We also need to add Russian pipeline exports to Turkey, which is not included in the calculation. And this is interesting because Turkey switched from oil indexation to hub indexation in 2022, and the prices in 2022 were really killing Turkey in terms of basically imposing a very heavy toll on it. And Russia also sell less gas to Turkey in 2022 compared with 2021, but made much more money. Same thing for former Soviet Union countries on Russia's western border. On the one hand, you have Belarus, where Russia sells gas at very low fixed price, just a little bit over $4 per MBTU. On the other hand, Moldova, for example, it doesn't buy as much gas, in fact, like seven times less than Belarus, but it paid the price somewhere close to $25-$27 per MBTU as year average. And so Russia was getting a lot of revenue on this end as well. Finally, another component is the growing revenue stream coming from Russian sales of gas to China. And this is driven primarily by volumes, because Russia has been ramping up the volumes of export, and also by the fact that the price for this contract is finally starting to catch up with oil price dynamics. There's a significant 9 months time lag in the calculation of the gas price according to the formula in this gas contract in Russia and China. And so it follows, gas price in this contract follows the oil price developments, but with a significant delay. And obviously, since Brent averaged almost $100 per barrel in 2022, so these higher price dynamics will add to the volume effect, and sort of year on year, the revenue stream on exports to China will also grow, even though in terms of comparing the price to China at price to Europe, obviously oil links prices were significantly lower and extremely competitive.
So in total, just briefly, Vitaly, in total, what do you estimate the export number was for 2022?
Well, again, I mean, it's really a ballpark estimation. And definitely higher than $100 billion. It's difficult to put an exact number of that. I wouldn't really risk of basically putting an exact number. But it was definitely higher than $100 billion overall.
And going forward for 2023, presumably that number comes down a little bit, or quite a lot.
Oh yeah, it comes down quite a lot, essentially, because all this upside that Russia had from exporting to Europe in 2022 will not be happening anymore. And I think that the numbers are going to go down very, very significantly. In fact, in terms of future export revenues from Russian pipeline gas, Russia and Gazprom, they're sitting on a time bomb, because I think the effects that were offsetting the volume shrinkage, essentially the price effects that were offsetting the disappearance, the shrinkage of the European gas market for Gazprom, they are going to be drastically reduced in 2023 and in 2024. And so in a couple of years' time, Gazprom revenue is going to go down very, very significantly. It doesn't mean that Gazprom will not have a sufficient amount of money to continue investing. Just to remind you, it doesn't really need to invest a lot into new productive capacity. It really needs to create some infrastructure that would allow it to channel all this available or potentially available gas production to new markets. So we are talking about additional investments into pipelines. But this is something that Gazprom can manage even with lower revenues, because basically it's off the peak of its major investments, because the major investments into new production, they have already happened.
Okay. We're coming to the end of our time now. We've got literally a couple of minutes left. So give us a quick word on LNG and what you see for Russian LNG output. Is the potential there significant, or is it being hampered by sanctions and lack of revenues?
Well, with LNG, I think the sanctions proved to be much more effective. Russia doesn't have its own large-scale liquefaction technology. It had to rely on the Western technologies for its existing projects. And the ambition that Russia had of reaching close to 100 million tons of LNG production and essentially exports by early 2030s, I think it has been put, this strategy has been put in complete disarray by the sanctions. Having said that, the projects that have reached a point of no return, like Arctic LNG 2, for this project, Novatek managed to purchase most of the necessary equipment and technology prior to the start of the war in Ukraine. There were a few important items missing, especially for trains 2 and 3. Train 1 of Arctic LNG 2 was supposed to be launched in 2023, and Novatek hasn't yet adjusted the start. Basically, they are saying that we will be ready, and before this year ends, we will launch a train 1 of Arctic LNG 2. Whether this is just keeping brave face, or is it a real plan? Well, time will tell, and time will tell very soon. But for train 2 and train 3, the key piece of missing equipment appears to be gas turbines produced by Baker Hughes. They are no longer available, and Novatek would need to find a way to procure some kind of substitutes for that. This brings another important consideration. As I said, Russia doesn't have its own large-scale liquefaction technology, but Novatek has developed a medium-scale liquefaction technology based on essentially Russian equipment and Russian technological solutions. It's called Arctic Cascade, and it has been implemented at Yamal LNG project, specifically at Train 4. Whereas the nameplate capacity of each of the three trains of Yamal LNG is 5.5 million tons per annum. Actual production for Yamal LNG was higher due to better efficiencies of operating in the cold climate. Train 4, in contrast, is much smaller. Nameplate capacity is only 0.9 million tons per annum. But as I said, cold climate has its advantages, because sort of liquefying gas when it's minus 30 or minus 40 outside is just a little bit easier compared to very warm weather. And in 2022, this fourth train produced a little bit over 1 million ton of LNG. Initially, some problems were reported for this Arctic Cascade technology, but apparently, just given the output numbers last year, Novatek managed to solve them, and now it appears to be a working technology, maybe with high unit costs compared to Western large-scale liquefaction. But nevertheless, now it appears to be working. Whether Novatek would have to change the design of its future projects and apply the module approach and deploy Arctic Scale, whether Novatek would have to deploy Arctic Cascade technology at its future projects to deal with unresolvable problems about sanctioned equipment, well, it remains to be seen. Definitely, it gives room for some medium-scale liquefaction projects in Russia to go forward.
Okay, great. Vitaly, that's great. A very good summary of the LNG situation. And I point people to your report, which is on our website, Catch-22 for Russian Gas, published towards the end of January. But thank you very much indeed for your contribution today. Thank you also to everyone for listening. Take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.